You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Hello, welcome to the 10th edition of the podcast. This week we're going to be focusing on attachment and trauma. And for many families this is a huge issue that dominates so much of their thinking and concern. So we're going to have a little talk to an expert in the field, someone who's got a huge range of experience, but I'll let them introduce yourselves. But if I could ask one thing, if you get 2 minutes spare, I'd really appreciate it if you could go to iTunes and rate the podcast, because that would make me feel really good about myself. No, seriously. It just means it gets spread out to a wider audience. So once again, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Al. How are you?
I'm very well. And yourself?
Yeah, not bad. Busy week.
Excellent. Rest of the week. Always busy. And we've also got Marie. Hello, Marie.
Oh, hi, Scott.
Hello.
So, Marie, give us your full title and tell us who you are and why should we be speaking to you today?
Oh, good question. So my name is Dr. Marie Kershaw. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been working in mental health in a range of services, adult forensics, child and adolescent services for about 17 years. And for about the last 12 of those years, I've been working in specialist services for looked after and adopted children.
That's a really good reason to speak.
And that's
to you
both
then.
Within. Yeah, so that's both within local authority and tier 3 NHS CAMHS type settings.
Oh, well, that's really interesting. And Scott kind of has met you at a few events, and I think he recommended that we talk to you. And I know that trauma is an issue for a lot of parents who care for adopted children, lots of foster carers as well, and lots of parents in general. So I have a few questions. Scott, do you have any questions prepared?
Do you know what? It's just a dulcet tones, Marie. I enjoy listening to her.
Yes.
It's the Scottish accent.
Oh, you're very kind. You're very kind.
I'm amazing.
Yeah, you're not really Scottish, either of you, because you live in England. So that doesn't count. I'm the most northern of the three of us. I do feel outnumbered.
No.
It's not true.
No, I'm just here for the banter, in honesty. So, you know. So.
The wit.
Yes, I provide it mainly. Because, you know,
excellent.
One of us has to be funny, don't we?
Well, I have a few questions, and they've been sort of rummaging around my head. And the first one is, right, explain, what is trauma?
What is trauma? Oh, my goodness, that is a good question. I think trauma is one of those things that probably there's a difference between the, you know, your everyday Joe Bloggs understanding of trauma and what we might mean as clinicians as trauma. And I think sometimes that's one of the things that can cause a bit of confusion between parents and professionals and not having a common language really about what is trauma, what constitutes trauma. So I think in everyday language, especially when we're thinking about the looked after and adopted field, we're often, you know, talking about kids who've been through very significant adversity, abuse, neglect, significant loss. And I suppose one of the key issues when we're thinking about all of that stuff is, to what degree do we think about that as adverse life experiences, and to what degree do we think about it as trauma? And I think it is difficult to define. I think in a clinical sense, you know, there are probably particular thresholds that you have to meet in order for something to constitute trauma. And I think that's one of the, you know, one of the tricky things really in conversations between parents and professionals. Mm-hmm. For people to make sense of that and for us to have a kind of common and shared language. I think one of the other things that confuses the issue is when we are thinking about different types of trauma. So especially in the adoption field and especially more recently, I think adoptive parents have become a lot more, you know, a lot more clued up around issues of trauma and have done lots of reading. And, you know, so we hear people talking about post-traumatic stress. We hear people talking about complex trauma, developmental trauma, interpersonal trauma. And I think it is hard for parents and professionals sometimes, to be quite honest, to have a common language about what it is that we're actually talking about.
That's really interesting, because I know that you just have to be on social media for an hour and you can see the word trauma thrown around in all kinds of different contexts. And I sometimes think, I'm not sure they mean what they're saying, developmental trauma, and just trauma in general. And I see the trauma and detachment. I was reading something on Facebook today. That's where I get all my essential information for life. Not really. And where trauma and attachment were kind of intrinsically linked, to the point of thinking, my understanding isn't that they're not hand in glove. They can be hand in glove, but there was they were sort of drawing a real conclusion towards reactive attachment disorder. I thought, blimey, that's a bit of a leap. So could you kind of give us a minute, the difference between trauma and attachment and the relationship? A minute's not fair. Have as long as you want on that one.
Okay. Well, that's a massive topic to talk about in 1 minute, but I will try and sum up.
Go on, have two, okay, live a
so
little.
You're right in what you say. So in this field, attachment and trauma are often talked about together, but they are two separate things. And I think where they become linked is when we start to think about trauma in the context of early relationships. So when we're thinking about attachment, what we're thinking about is our very early early relationships with our primary caregiver.
Yeah.
So that's what we're thinking of in attachment relationships. And so depending on the nature and the quality of that early attachment relationship, children will develop different ways of coping with the world, different ways of perceiving the world, perceiving themselves, different ways of managing their emotions, and the sort of managing the interplay between their thoughts and their feelings. So attachment, we're talking about attachment, we're predominantly talking about our primary relationships with our primary caregivers that influence a whole host of developmental functions in children.
So that's impacting through things like their internal working model. It's like a lens that they see the world, their relationships, and how they make sense of those relationships.
Yeah, sure. So attachment relationships are important for lots of different areas of child development. As you've said, it's important in terms of our development of our sense of self, our development in trust in other people, our development of the sense of safety in the world around us, our emotion regulation. And I think the easiest way to think about attachment, because we can get very caught up in attachment, but I think the easiest way to understand attachment is a kind of a way to survive your world. So depending on the quality and the nature of the relationships you have, if we think about different attachment styles as being almost different ways of coping or relating to the world, depending on the early experiences that we've had. So obviously children who've had secure attachment relationships where they can rely on adults to meet their needs, they can trust in adults, they develop a coherent sense of self and a positive sense of self. When those children with attachment and with secure attachment relationships come up against the ebbs and flows and bumps of life, or indeed come up against future traumas, because none of us are immune to trauma in our life, a secure attachment acts as a buffer, a protective factor against the impact of trauma later in life. So that's not to say that children who have attachment security will never be affected by trauma, but if we think about it in terms of risk and protective factors, a secure attachment is likely to act as a protective factor against stress and trauma in our lives. So we know, that children who've experienced significant attachment disruption, disorganized attachment styles, are more at risk of developing difficulties later in life.
Yeah.
But those children also have a double whammy, because in the context of our kids, looked after adopted children, what you often find is that they experience their trauma in the context of their attachment relationships.
So that their ability to manage that, their resilience is fundamentally undermined.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't have the same foundations of resilience. They don't have the same buffer, if you like, that children who've had secure attachments have in helping to protect them against the effects of trauma. And because, you know, whereas for many children who don't come from the care system or who've had, you know, good enough, you know, early developmental experiences, they have scaffolding. The difference between those children and often children in the looked after adopted population is that their trauma occurred very early on in life. So they didn't have the chance to develop that scaffolding, that buffer zone, to help them to cope.
I think you've raised some really interesting issues, and I don't know about you, Scott, but when I was preparing to be an adopter and a foster carer, attachment was talked about. And I know as a social worker, we had a whole module that was solely focused on growth and development, with a huge, maybe 7 or 8 lectures, a full, you know, 3,500 word essay on attachment. So I think attachment has been pushed really hard. And I don't know, is that your experience, Scott?
Well, these days, yes, I totally agree with you. But let me tell you, 10 years ago, and I don't know about when you first started coming through this process, but I remember saying to our social worker, once our two older ones had been placed, about attachment. And she looked at me like I'd grown 2 kind of heads. She really didn't know what it was. Now, that was 10 years ago, and I'm not sure how much kind of awareness there was, but we found out about it through websites. And quite likely American websites, in all honesty. And I'm fascinated, Marie. I really am. I mean, I'm not saying I understand every single thing you're saying, because I'm not professional. Okay, I'm just a parent who has a bit of banner well on a Thursday night. But it's interesting how these kinds of things have now come into play. But as parents, 10 years ago, we were saying, oh, we think our child, you know, may have the effects of trauma and it's affecting his attachment. And it was just like, well, what is attachment? We're not quite sure what you mean by attachment disorders and things like that. So, and today, by absolute chance, we've had our first post-adoption support assessment, and trauma was brought up every single time, every couple of minutes, in terms of the kind of needs of the kids. So to go from nothing to it just being so full on trauma all the time, I think that, you know, like Al, I see it on Twitter all the time. So it's really fascinating to hear that it's recognised, and actually it's recognised in terms of trying to parent these children.
Absolutely. And I think it is, you know, for many parents of adopted children or foster carers of children in the care system, I think it is really, really important for people to understand the potential impact, you know, the developmental impact of disrupted attachment relationships and early developmental trauma. I suppose one caveat that I would say to that is that you guys were just reflecting on your experience over the last kind of 10 years or so, and I think for me, I've been through an interesting journey as well, because, you know, 10, 12 years ago, people weren't always talking so much, as you say, about attachment and trauma, although these are not new concepts, which is quite an interesting thing in itself. But certainly, you know, in mainstream services, people were not talking about it as readily. Certainly, adoptive parents and carers were not as clued up as they are now. I mean, I've seen a massive shift in the sort of, if you like, the kind of baseline understanding that adoptive parents have around issues of attachment and trauma, which is fantastic that people have that awareness. And it's, you know, I feel like a lot of people have been pushing really hard, you know, myself and other people included, to try and make people, you know, help people to develop this awareness. But I suppose the one thing I would reflect on is I do sometimes wonder whether we've almost gone too far the other way in our keenness to help parents and systems understand the impact, because, you know, just because someone has experienced experienced adversity or just because they've experienced trauma doesn't mean that they're going to have significant difficulties at the most extreme level. And I think it's really important in our conversations about attachment and trauma that we hold in mind that for any mental health, emotional well-being, psychological health issue, we're always talking in terms of risk factors and protective factors. And when you're talking about trauma, I think in developing the debate around these issues, it's useful to hold in mind that we don't jump to the conclusion that because my child had disruptions in their early attachment, they must have an attachment disorder, or because my little one had a difficult start in life, they must be traumatized. It's really important that we hold those things in mind and definitely be curious about those things. But we need to be careful that we don't over-pathologize children when they may have some mild impact. But do we then start to see all of their behavior through that trauma lens? And do we start to, almost have a sort of a bias the other way where we become too clued in?
I mean, that is one thing that I've slightly concerned me is that I've seen people using it as a banner, a flag, in what felt like an unhealthy way, saying, "Oh, well, my child is X, my child is this, they have had that experience." And I understand that that often comes out of a frustration and a desire to get help and to generate, understanding for their child. But there's a feeling that, especially with attachment, and there's a few groups that I'm not part of, but or actually I might be part of, I better be careful what I say, but if you've only got a hammer, every problem is a nail. Moving on from there, do you see any negative consequences of parents being given limited information or just enough to kind of wave the flag of attachment or trauma?
I think what I would always encourage parents to do, in the same way that I encourage professionals to do, is to embrace that attitude of pace. Many adoptive parents will be aware of what I mean by pace, but for anybody who isn't, so Dan Hughes, who's a clinical psychologist, talks a lot about needing an attitude of pace in your parenting of children. So pace stands for playfulness, acceptance, curiosity, and empathy. And I think that's a really, really important attitude to have when we're trying to make sense of children's difficulties. If we go in with an assumption that we know, then actually that's not an open and engaged stance to come from. And the risk of that is that you will see difficulties through a particular lens or with a particular bias. And whether you're a parent or you're a professional, I think it's really important when we're trying to make sense of a child's difficulties that we go in with an attitude of curiosity, to be open to a range of possibilities about what might be contributing to the difficulties. And, as a psychologist, one of our core trainings is in something called formulation. And, formulation really in a nutshell is about looking at all of the information in front of you, drawn on a number of sources, and then trying to draw together a coherent understanding or a hypothesis about what might be behind a certain issue or a certain difficulty. And it's that formulation that then informs any intervention that you might do or any support. And I do worry sometimes that we see X and jump to Z and we've kind of missed out steps. And I think if there was one thing that I would really encourage people to do, whether you're a parent or a professional, is when you're working with these children, be open and be curious to the whole range of issues that might be contributing to what, the difficulties that a family's experiencing. So, it's not a very psychological term, but one of the things I often talk to parents about is this idea of that, like, it's like a big mashup. You've got all these sort of typical child stuff, because kids are not straightforward. They're complicated little babies. So you've got all this sort of typical child development stuff, rages, tantrums, struggling with boundaries, transitioning to adolescence, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Then you've got all of the additional stuff, all the sort of possibly attachment trauma, impact of neglect, neurodevelopmental kind of stuff going on. But then we've also got the parent stuff, you know, and whether that's around, you know, unresolved issues around loss or, you know, grief for the child that they didn't have. So I think there's a lot of taboos that we're still not great at talking about in respect to, you know, the adoptive parents' stuff. And sometimes the difficulties happen when all that stuff mashes together. And so if we're only looking at one part of that mashup, if we're only looking at one aspect of those factors, then sometimes we can be at risk of missing the whole picture.
And I think that's a really interesting point, because we've touched on it before, Scott, haven't we, where we've sort of said we've met adopters and we've kind of really clearly seen that they're, as individuals, they are bringing their own, how shall I say nicely, they're bringing their own cake to the party. And it's a combination. It's we live within systems, don't we? We complex systems, and they're moving and evolving constantly. You know, we have our own stuff in our own life, our own pressures that, you know, I know that if I'm worried about the mortgage, then I'm in a bad mood. So things that wouldn't normally wind me up, wind me up. And that's just, you know, it's just dad stuff. But that is interesting you said that, because that leads me on to my next question. And I was going to ask you about, well, one is about the preparation of adopters in relation to around trauma and attachment. But you've kind of touched on another area there, which is about them preparing themselves. So do you have any input professionally into that, or any thoughts professionally?
Yeah, I have done in the past, and I think this probably reflects a little bit of how services have progressed in the time that I've been involved. So some years ago, I was asked to come and be part of the adoptive preparation training and to do, you know, help them to do some thinking around attachment and trauma, impact of loss, impact of separation, and a little bit on helping the adults think about their own attachment histories and how that might interplay with the children. But I work very much from a sort of dyadic developmental practice model, which is as much about supporting the network and the systems and the teams around children as it is about doing direct work with families. So one of the things that I've been really keen to do in my role is to help with the development of other staff. So helping the social workers to develop, you know, a more comprehensive understanding of some of these issues. So I'm not directly involved in the prep training anymore, because we've kind of passed on that knowledge more widely within the system. And so the social workers do that training, you know, for themselves within the system. And indeed, I recently moved services, and when I moved into my new service, what I found was actually the social workers in that team were already really well placed to do that level of training for families, which for me was brilliant, because it just shows me how far the systems have come since I first started working in adoption 10-12 years ago.
Right. And any questions, Scott?
No, I'm listening. I'm listening intently. I'm making notes.
You're making notes. He's going to take this knowledge and use it as his own.
Yeah. that's all good. Take it and spread it. I think one of the challenges with prep training is how much do you tell people and at what point?
Yeah.
Because I think probably, you know, in my experience, at the point that parents are doing prep training, they, you know, they're still in the sort of zone of, I just really want this to happen, and I'm kind of hearing what you're telling me, but and I get it, and I'm listening, and I know what you're saying is true, Marie, but
it's going to be them,
you know,
not
there's
me.
Always that, but yes, you know, we're going to be okay, because, you know, yeah, we're going to think about this, but it, and I think that's really understandable, you know, because, you know, for any parent, whether you're a birth parent or an adoptive parent or a foster carer, you know, at the point that you decide, I really want kids, you just really want those kids.
Yeah.
You know, you just want them with all your heart and soul and being, and it doesn't matter what anybody says, you just long for that. And so I think there's always a limit to really how fully people are able to process that information at that stage of their journey, which is why I think it's really important that we come back to it. I think sometimes people are a little bit, you know, sometimes professionals can be a little bit nervous about, well, how much information do we give people, because we want to keep it balanced and we don't want to scare people away from the adoption process, because for many, many families, it is an incredible, you know, an incredibly positive experience. And I think sometimes when you work in services where by default the only reason people come and see you is because there's a difficulty, we can sometimes lose sight of the whole huge broad spectrum of adoption experience. And actually, yeah, some adoptive families never need to come near you know, additional support, and some do. And so I think it's always a tricky balance in prep training as to, you know, how much information are people able to hear, to what depth do you go into it. And for me, prep training is that, it's prep, it's not the be-all and end-all of what adopters might need. You know, people need the chance to come back and consolidate that learning and reflect on that, have opportunities for consultation around, well, okay, so maybe now we're a bit further down the line and we've got a child who we're considering a match with. So what does all that stuff mean to me? What does it mean for, you know, this child that might be placed with us? So for me, having the opportunity for consultation with adoptive parents when they're a little bit further down the journey and there's a real child in the mix, something that they can actually pin that theory and that earlier knowledge and training onto, I think is much more helpful.
It is. I mean, it's a universal question, and I've had it when I was a panel member. How much do you share? How much do you not share? You know, how much can people absorb? How much are people willing to absorb? Or will you just terrify everyone? And we're looking at the whole issue of child-parent violence and looking at the prevalence. And when you realise it's, I mean, I think we're looking at, you know, a third of families are struggling and it's a feature in their lives. So in a room of 30 people, 10, you know, 10 people, you might be struggling, but can those people hear it? Should those people hear it? Ethical, lots of ethical questions around that. Now, I'm going to move on because time is ticking. I've had half an hour of your time and I'm aware that it's late. One question I did have, which was about trauma, was vicarious trauma. I mean, you'll know what vicarious trauma is, but is that something you see in some of the adopters and foster carers that come across your door? Tell me what a vicarious trauma is. Explain to the people who are listening.
Okay. So this would be a good example of where it's important to have a common language around what you mean by a certain topic. So vicarious trauma, do you mean, explain to me what you would mean by
that. No, my understanding of vicarious trauma is that because of people who have been traumatized, you are re-traumatized by their stories, by their experiences. That is the impact of that. Not the impact of their behavior in the home, but their own experiences. I think I've done that very badly. Go on, you tell me what vicarious trauma is.
So I suppose in a kind of lay sense, what you're asking is, you know, to what degree are parents impacted, or can they be impacted by their experience of their child's trauma, by their experience of parenting a child with trauma, and by the impact that has on them as parents?
Yeah, I think I'm seeing it as two definite things, because I think that parents are traumatized by their children's behavior and outworking of trauma. So the way they manifest in the homes, so that's one thing. But that's not a vicarious trauma, that's a trauma, potentially. And vicarious is that, you know, if you've got a child who's had a very difficult, traumatic experience, that you, even hearing that experience and living with them, that you are traumatized. So it's not behavior against you, it's there. I think I'm rubbish at this. There's a reason I'm not a psychologist.
I think it goes back to what we're saying about definitions of trauma.
Right.
I think the more, you know, the more robust that you are as a person, as an individual, as a parent, the more coping resources that you have to help you deal with the impact of your child's experiences in terms of how able you are to hear that, in terms of how able you are to cope with that and manage that and process that. And I think it is significant in terms of how able you then are, you know, if we think about one of the primary functions of attachment relationships is around co-regulation and co-containment. Mm-hmm. And if we think one of the primary goals of therapeutic parenting is about helping the children to process and make sense of and integrate their past experiences in relation to their present experiences, I think where the adopters struggle with the child's trauma, it's much harder for them to support the children in processing that trauma. So sometimes what can happen is that the parents and the children end up triggering dysregulation in each other, which makes the task of co-regulation much more tricky.
Yeah.
And sometimes for those parents, that might be an example of where they might need some additional support to help them with that, because we know that you can't co-regulate unless you're first self-regulated. So sometimes the task in supporting adoptive families is working with the adoptive parents to help them come to a place of better self-regulation and increased capacity to cope with the challenges of meeting the children's needs or mm-hmm. being able to hear and process that trauma. So sometimes the work isn't directly with the children, but it's around helping the adoptive parents to develop their coping repertoire so that they can then support the children. And I think sometimes parents are really receptive to that, and I think sometimes parents struggle a little bit with that because they may be, you know, sometimes we can get into dialogue about, but it's the child that needs the support. And sometimes part of the work is helping the parents to realise the role that they play in that recovery. Mm-hmm. But if they themselves feel traumatised or highly distressed by the child's experience or the child's playing out of their trauma experience, that's sometimes where the parenting dynamic comes unstuck. And that would be a good example of what I was talking about earlier when we talk about the big stuff mashup, yeah. where the child stuff and the parent stuff clash. So rather than the parent being able to respond to and co-regulate the child's distress, they get pulled into the child's distress and everybody in the system becomes dysregulated and fragmented.
Yeah, that's messy, isn't it?
That makes absolute sense.
I think what you're saying that actually it's really complicated, isn't it? Having families and systems and, you know, adopters wanting, you know, fix this bit of this child, and it's often much more nuanced and there's a much more sort of transactional thing going on, isn't there, between parents and children?
Sure. So, I mean, if you think about what we were talking about earlier in terms of the interplay between attachment and trauma, if we think that, you know, for the children who present with the more complex difficulties, often their difficulties are coming out of early developmental trauma in the context of their attachment relationships. So if you like, the trauma happened in the context of their relationships, usually their parenting relationships. And so often the best way to heal that trauma is in the context of their relationships.
Yeah.
And so that's why then the adoptive parents become such an important part of therapy and recovery. You know, and in the model that, you know, that myself and lots of other people work from, the parents or the adoptive parents are really central to the therapeutic process.
And I think that's been my experience. I don't know about you, Scott, but my experience has been that the most effective therapy has been us all sat in a room talking about things that happened. And, you know, and recently a psychiatrist kind of said to me, you need to be like a tree. You need to be calm. You need to be, you know, you need to kind of have a sense of stillness about you, because there's lots of stuff going on, and you mustn't feel like you're being destroyed. And it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it wasn't about my kids. It was about me. If I can get keep my stuff together, then...
Yeah, I think it's easy to keep your stuff together when it's you, but I think that there are occasions where it's really difficult.
Absolutely.
It is really difficult. And
I think as a parent, actually.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. And, you know, there's times where you're pushed and pushed and pushed, and I don't move my rag very easily as a parent, but actually when I do, but I recognise that in myself. I used to flip quite easily, but actually over the years I've harnessed that and decided that actually my issues are not their issues. So mm-hmm. I need to deal with my own stuff to be able to deal with theirs. And I think that's why I kind of have a balanced view on these kinds of issues, mm-hmm. rather than I'm not saying that I'm not affected by them. Of course, I mean, you would be, if anybody with any empathy in them would be affected by these issues that these children have. But there's a difference between being able to balance that with the kind of day-to-day living that we have to go through to kind of parent these children, and an actual the extremes of actually really, really affecting our own mental health.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's really difficult to balance.
Because, I know this will come as a surprise to many of you, but, adoptive parents are human.
Are we? No.
I can vouch for that.
Just common garden humans. I've heard this sort of term, super parent and super therapeutic parent bandied about. And, I mean, what does that even mean anyway? We're all humans. We all have our own pressure points. We all have our own vulnerabilities. We all have our own limits.
Yeah.
And, sometimes for children who've experienced trauma in the context of their attachment relationship, they will reenact that trauma through their attachment relationships. And that's often why, their parents are the ones who get it in the neck when school's saying, fine, he's golden all day at school, and parents are going, no, he's not. He's not. Because the trauma's not being triggered, it's not being reenacted at school. At school, relationships are more superficial. There's no expectation of intimacy. There's much less intersubjectivity. There's much less true emotional connectedness. That stuff is only really triggered in the context of their parents and your job of parenting them and their job of being parented by you. And that's where it comes unstuck. So, these kids are, can be, not deliberately, I don't want to make it sound like they're sort of deliberately trying to, drive you all to distraction, but by the nature of their trauma and how that manifests, they find your buttons and they will push them hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sometimes, and they do that for different reasons, but it's usually a manifestation of their trauma. And it gives us good clues to how unsafe they feel, actually. But as a parent dealing with that 24/7, it's exhausting.
Yeah. I mean, that leads me to I'm going to ask a last question because I'm aware of the time. Is there hope? Can trauma be healed? Is that too simplistic a way of even asking the question? What's the outcomes? Are they good?
Sure. There's always hope. Without hope, what do we have left? I think for me, I think one of the strongest things that we can do for kids, and you can think back to, probably your own childhood or, other kids around you. When you think somebody believes in you, you can do anything. And these kids don't believe in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't had an experience of other people really believing in them, really caring about them, really being all absorbed in them. And that's what we need to do. We need to help these kids to realize that we believe in them. And yes, for some kids, the road will be bumpy. I don't want to paint a picture of, if we can all just therapeutically super parent, we can all sail into the sunset. For some children, they will struggle and they will have difficulties. But, you know, given where they've come from, actually, they're doing amazingly well. And I think sometimes it's about remembering where they've come from and how far they've come. And, you know, for some children, will they ever catch up to the trajectory they might have been on if they'd never experienced developmental trauma? Maybe not, but maybe they don't need to. You know, maybe we're setting up a false expectation, and maybe that's where some of the frustration and, you know, parents fear that they're failing or they're not pushing hard enough, or maybe if they could just try a bit harder and get a bit of a better service, then it will all be okay. And I think sometimes it is about what are our expectations, and, you know, that goes back to having an attitude of pace and an attitude of acceptance. And I think with that, I don't mean just kind of saying, oh, well, you know, they're traumatized, let them just, you know, fudge along through life. Of course not. Every parent wants to help their child and encourage them to develop, but with the caveat of, you know, they started from a place of disadvantage. I mean, I wouldn't still be doing this job, you know, 12 years later if I didn't see change in families. You know, I've seen some incredible change in families. I've seen some families who, I've seen families where they've changed more than I could ever have dreamed. I've worked with families where we've shifted so far, and then they've, you know, they've come as far as they can. We maybe take a break from therapy for a couple of years, and then, you know, the kids shift a little bit developmentally or cognitively, or something shifts in the family, and they come back a couple of years later, and we do a little bit more.
Yeah.
We're not necessarily going to fix it all in one go. You know, that's the other thing that I would say. Sometimes we have an expectation that, you know, there's a problem, we come into therapy, we fix it, we go away completely done. And sometimes therapy doesn't work that way. You know, we come in, do a bit, we go away, we consolidate it, we develop, we learn, then we come back for a bit more and we maybe go a little bit further the next time, and that's okay as well.
Yeah, and that's, you definitely know, sadly, my experience.
For some families, you know, yeah, for some families, sadly, you know, I have worked with who have gone through adoption breakdown. And, you know, sometimes then the aim of therapy is, okay, well, if for whatever reason, lots of complex reasons, things have got to the point of breakdown, how do we help that to break down in the least damaging way possible?
Yeah.
So how do we break down, how does that breakdown happen in a way where families can still maintain contact with each other, where they can still have a positive role in each other's lives, but maybe they can't live together? So I guess what I'm trying to say in the long and short of it is there is always hope. The degree to which it will be easy to shift will depend on a number of risk and protective factors that vary from child to child and family to family. But certainly, you know, with support and sometimes with the need of specialist services, sometimes just with, you know, peer-to-peer parents support, sometimes just having somebody to offload to so that you can stay regulated enough to do the daily challenge of parenting, that's enough. I think, you know, some families will need specialist intervention and some families won't, and it will depend on a number of factors. So I'm not an advocate of, you know, this child's been traumatized, therefore they must come in for specialist therapy. But equally, if that's what a family needs, then they should be able to access that as well.
Yeah. In an ideal world, that's the way it should be, isn't it? You know, there should be different tiers of kind of support that you can access.
Definitely agree
that, you know, in some occasions, actually, the peer support bit is more of, not more effective, it's sometimes as equally effective as the kind of the next kind of tier up, if you like, so accessing to other services. So I agree with you on that. I think that peer support is quite important. Absolutely. And that can actually help to save money in the long run as well. So
I think just one last thing I would say about that is, you know, sometimes, again, I think language is important, and I think sometimes when we think of, I tend to talk about services in terms of layers, because tiers kind of assumes that this tier is better than this tier, or, you know, this tier is not going to be as effective as this tier. And I agree with you, Scott, that, you know, some things that are really useful adjunct. And if we think about it in terms of layers, you know, we can sometimes, you know, we need to work at a layer of support in the parents before they're ready to go into a therapeutic process. Sometimes we might actually need to help the system around the children. So actually the work's not in therapy. It's helping the school to think about how to support them better in their day-to-day functioning. And then they don't come home and melt down so much, you know, and then the parents aren't tearing their hair out and then everyone can stay regulated. So it's like a sort of ripple effect, I suppose. That's the way I think of support, depending on, you know, on what the need is. I think sometimes parents can feel a bit hard done by if you talk about it in terms of tiers and you're offering tier one and they think they need tier four. And,
I get that.
But actually they're all just as valid, you know, depending on what the need is, they're all just as valid and just as effective, depending on what the individual need of the family is.
Yeah, I think the scaffolding isn't just around the children, it's around, got to be around the family and the community around that child. And we've seen that with them, with one of my daughters, is that as she grows and develops, and there's been an ebb and flow to therapy, and then there's been a, you know, there's times when we need a lot of scaffolding, and then the scaffolding comes down a bit, and then the reality is that there's not one size fits all, you know, for every, she gets older, we need something different. We need to pull back or push forwards. I think it's worrying when people are kind of, you know, when I speak to adopters who are like pushing, or we've got to have therapy X or this or that, that's that you think, there is no one solution. There's you know, the problem is a mashup, like you said, and the solution is usually a mashup as well. Do you know, it's been fantastic speaking to you, Mary, and I really do appreciate it. And Scott, as always, you've been helpful and entertaining.
Mary, thank you for agreeing to talk to us. It's been really, really interesting.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you very much. It's been good to talk.
Good.
Excellent. Well, look after yourselves, and I hope you both have really fantastic weeks. Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.